Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about our Appendix N, the literature and the inspirational resources that Paul and I, the Wandering DMs, find most critical to our fantasy D&D games. And huge thanks to our patron, Bill Rubine, for suggesting this. And like I said to Paul a couple minutes back, this is something that almost, I mean, we constantly call ourselves people of the book, or at least I do. And it's almost like this could have been the very first episode we ever did. And it's so close to us that we needed someone else to point it out as a great topic for us. So huge thanks to Bill for saying that we should discuss our personal literary inspirations. What a great idea.
Yeah. Excellent idea. Now, of course, we've done... We did an episode, I believe, with the publishers of Appendix N, right?
With Peter Bebergal, who edited that wonderful book, I think last year. Last week we were talking to Ramsey Campbell, who was one of the writers of the Swords Against Darkness series, which is listed in Appendix N. We had an episode talking to the Goodman Games guys when they had their Dying Earth boxed set game on. So it's something we come back and probably a whole bunch of other stuff that I'm forgetting over time. So it's something we keep coming back to time and time again.
Dan, I've forgotten to close my door. I'm going to stand up and do that. But while I do so, give us, I'm sure most of our listeners don't need this, but give us the quick elevator pitch on what the heck is Appendix N?
So specifically, the first edition Dungeon Master's Guide by Gary Gygax ends with a number of appendices, and there is, in fact, an Appendix N titled Inspirational and Educational Reading, and there's a list of fantasy authors and fantasy books and stories there that he says is most important for the sensibility of D&D. A lot of pulp stuff on that list from, like, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, actually. And so we continually go back to that, and it's a lot. You could spend a long, here is the list from the original Appendix N, and you could spend a long time trying to read this list of literatures, and some of us have spent time trying to compile a library that contains all those things. I certainly haven't done it yet. And other authors, of course, frequently have inspirational reading at the end of rule books a lot, but the Appendix N, we are talking about Gary Gygax's first edition list
here. It's interesting. I was actually surprised when you showed me the screenshot of how short it is in AD&D. I immediately thought of the basic inspirational source list, which, you know, is quite a bit longer and is broken down into sections such as young adult fantasy, adult fantasy, short story collections, nonfiction. And then you and I quickly went on a tear there of, like, what other editions does it exist in? And we found it in fifth edition. And actually, fifth edition even goes so far as to include an appendix of things on, like, authorship and creative writing sort of in their DMG, which is interesting. Anyway. Regardless,
third edition D&D didn't have it. If I recall correctly, Goodman Games Dungeon Crawl Classics has, I think, Appendix N just replicated, just a copy of Appendix N. And then immediately after that, they have Appendix O of modern online resources like blogs and resources and internet tools and stuff like that, which is very helpful.
Now, the fascinating thing for me is when you told me this topic, the first thing that came to mind for me was actually some recent news that came through on the internet about the upcoming Dungeons & Dragons movie. For those who aren't aware, there have already been three Dungeons & Dragons movies. None of them are very good. The buzz on the internet that I've heard is that maybe this one is actually maybe going to be okay. and specifically Chris Pine, the actor who's in the movie, was in an interview and asked about it, and he hemmed and hawed a bit for trying to not like accidentally give any spoilers, but said this of the movie. The way that I've been describing it, it's like Game of Thrones mixed with a Little Princess Bride and just a smidge of Holy Grail. So I find that fascinating because, again, here we are referencing inspirational works. And, you know, the question or the problem, I feel like the problem with the past Dungeons & Dragons movies is that D&D isn't really an IP. It's not a setting. Right. Like if you're making a movie about Dungeons and Dragons,
right.
I don't think you can just make a generic fantasy story, maybe with a couple D&D monsters in it and call that done. Right. I feel like the content, the setting of Dungeons and Dragons is the game itself. So I want to see stuff where we are actually juxtaposing a fantasy setting against in some way a real world setting. And that's what I found that quote just fascinating because he quotes Princess Bride. And that's the first thing that comes to my mind with Princess Bride is, yeah, that there's actually, you know, there's bits in that movie that are set, you know, they play with the notion of this is a story, right? This is there's a grandfather and a child in modern day, and they're reading a book together. And the book is the story.
Yeah. And it's interesting that the first two of the three things there are originally books. Right, so Princess Bride was originally a book, and Game of Thrones, the Fire and Ice series, was originally books, and of course they became wildly popular movies or TV series. But originally, they are literature, and so it's interesting that they're pointing back to book sources, which is a good move, I think.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Does it matter if it's? I don't know. I know you love your quote of it being. What is it? People of the book. I don't know that it being a written medium is necessarily the most important thing. But I do want to see it acknowledged that this is a game. That this is a fantasy. That this is a not real thing. I don't know. I want to see some element of some juxtaposition, real world, fantasy world.
I like the Princess Bride's meta framing myself. I am going to be really surprised if they actually put that in a D&D movie. I'm going to be I will be very surprised. I don't think that's I doubt that that's interesting. I would be very surprised if I could see that on screen.
Yeah, I didn't mean to like make predictions about what the movie's going to be like, but it's interesting that he called it, right? That he called out Princess Bride as an inspirational. Yeah. And Holy Grail, frankly, because Holy Grail is silly. Right? So I'm assuming that's what he's getting at with Holy Grail is the humor aspect.
Yeah.
So that's fascinating.
And there's a lot of that in Princess Bride too. So let's talk about Paul.
Yeah, well, I was just going to ask you, Dan. What's your, you know, what are your inspirational readings? What do you read or watch, or what content when you're done with it makes you go, I want to play D&D now?
Okay, now I fear that we've bitten off too much in this episode. I'll say that. So I fear that we're going to get down to this, and we'll get a tiny little slice of the important literature. And currently, to my left, I pulled out books from my bookcase, and I've completely covered my desk about 6 or 10 books high here of stuff that is important to me. And probably will be leaving out a whole bunch of stuff accidentally and feel embarrassed about it later on. So please, viewers, tell us in the chat important stuff to you that I'm overlooking. I mean, my first app is there's a lot in the actual Appendix N that, I do, in fact, want to go back to the Touchstone. And there is a lot of sensibilities in the D&D game rules that aren't written down. And you do have to do a little bit of investigation, maybe by someone like me or Peter Bebergal or John Peterson or something like that. And then all of a sudden, when you find the right touchstone, all of a sudden the rules or a spell or a magic item suddenly make a lot more sense that's in D&D. So the top ones... I feel for the magic sensibility, I'm really, really glad that I read Jack Vance's Dying Earth. In particular, I love the fact that in the very first book, Turgeon of Mir, he explicitly says magic is mathematics. And I almost feel like I don't dig into that. That always makes me want to dig into that more in my games. And I haven't done so yet. But if you're going to understand how the magic spell system was set up, obviously you need to read Jack Vance. And then the other thing that Gygax calls out in the magic section. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to dig into Vance and Dying Earth just a little bit more. Yes, the magic system for sure. The other thing that strikes me about very D&D about that is just Cudgel's attitude, right? He, this kind of self-absorbed, trying to get you're ahead by whatever means. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that strikes me. A lot of my D&D games circle around characters like that, right? That the players are always trying to angle for self-promotion more than other things. I've not played a lot of games that are, sweeping epics about saving the world. Which is, again, maybe some people are playing a lot of games of D&D that are like that, but that theme for me strikes home. On the flip side, I'll say the downside to it is that it centers around a single character, which is not like a D&D game for me.
Yeah, and so I think that Cudgel is a very interesting character. Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser might be a better, even better emblem of what D&D is like. So when I read Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser by Lieber, and it's funny because last week Ramsey Campbell brought up Lieber. We didn't even mention him before Campbell brought him up as being an important author. Mm-hmm. And when I read a number of Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser stories, like Jewels in the Forest, Stardock, Howling Tower, Bazaar of the Bazaar, stuff like that, that stuff feels more like a D&D game than anything to me. And of course it predates the game. Yeah. So that's the stuff that very, very much feels like D&D game for me. And it's a team and it's episodic. Now, the other thing I will say in these, episodes, so a lot of the original literature is pulp short stories. And, frankly, later in life, I've become more convinced that it's those episodic pulp stories that are really a better resource or something that's actually I enjoy reading more than novel-like length stuff. And a lot of these authors, like Lieber, like Moorcock, right, as the publishing industry evolved, started writing longer form stories, started writing novels. And I find me personally that they're not as valuable or intense or dense with content as the short stories were. So nowadays you almost have to hunt for the short story versions, but I find that they're really more like the game, which is not too surprising because we're playing the game, week after week in these separated segments.
I feel like the classic kind of counterpoint to a lot of what you're talking about here, whether it's episodic content or just thematics of sort of the moral compass of the characters, is Tolkien, right? Like let's talk a little bit about Tolkien here, right? Because Tolkien, obviously, there's a big history of Tolkien in D&D. A lot of the original stuff had direct Tolkien references. Clearly, Tolkien was very popular when D&D came out, but then there was all this pushback to like scrub it from D&D. But all that aside, and specifically, I want to talk about Lord of the Rings here, which I've got up here, The Fellowship of the Ring. There's some good stuff in here in terms of like, yes, wizards and dwarves and elves, and it's about a team, right? A group going off to do a thing. But I would say on the flip side, some of the stuff that gets wrong for D&D is it is sweeping and epic. And about personal personal internal struggles of Frodo to overcome this peril, which I don't feel like I see that in D&D games, right? You don't see Frodo trying to resist the ring in D&D much.
I agree with that. And so as usual, Paul, you have so the thing that I actually have on my list to talk about last, this is going to be my denouement. The last thing I was going to mention was Lord of the Rings, was and our so drinks. As usual, you picked what I considered the most important thing first. So good for you. Okay. And of course, you know, Tolkien and Lord of the Rings are on Appendix N.
Yep.
So sure. If, you know, someone argues that it's not part of the legacy of D&D, it's totally in Gygax's Appendix N. And before D&D was ever published and Gygax was printing some stuff in hobby magazines, we're starting to do some kind of strategy war game stuff, but we're bringing in fantasy elements specifically from Tolkien, is what he said. That was the very first, you know, fantasy elements that he was bringing in and talking about. And my horrible guilty confession is I haven't managed to read Lord of the Rings yet. And I've tried about three times, frankly, and I get a little bit long. I get a little bit further into Fellowship of the Ring every time. And honestly, I still haven't managed to do it. And it's so embarrassing for me. Now, I love The Hobbit. Okay. I've read The Hobbit, you know, more than once. And I think one of our patrons, Joshua, probably about a week ago said, you know, The Hobbit really works a lot better for D&D, the Lord of the Rings. And I certainly agree with that. Let me pull up a message here.
Joshua said, I actually think The Hobbit is far more like D&D than Lord of the Rings is. I totally agree with you on that, Joshua, 100%. Personally, I would even say for my own taste, I would even say it's a better book. But it does read like, you know, it's the themes are a little bit more in line with D&D. Now, the one thing I'll say, again, just to be devil's advocate here, what does it get wrong? Is it about a party? Is it about a group? Or is it just about Bilbo? If I was trying to imagine The Hobbit as a D&D game, I actually envision it as a DM and a single player, and that player is playing Bilbo, and he's got 13 henchmen. And they're, it feels very early D&D to me, right? Like, okay, I hire 13 dwarves.
Yeah, completely. And, you know, let me throw up a chat, a good observation from Eric Worldbender here, too, on that. So Eric's saying, my first Lord of the Rings was the Bakshian Rankin-Bass Hobbit. I hadn't even started reading yet. And I'm pretty close to the same thing, Eric. I actually had a teacher in the sixth grade read The Hobbit to us, like maybe a chapter a day for a couple months. And I also saw that same movie you're talking about, and I had the record. I had the audio LP record of the Rankin-Bass Hobbit, and I played it over and over and over again to the extent that I remembered a lot of the lines and how they're delivered, as a matter of fact. So I think The Hobbit's great. And you know, another thing, Paul, that you might possibly overlook is that The Hobbit also has a lot of meta connections. There's a lot of places in The Hobbit, and to our understand, Tolkien sort of made up that story on the fly as a bedtime story for his kids or something like that. And there's a lot of places in The Hobbit where they go, well, reader, I'm sure that you can guess what happens next because it's very obvious how this puzzle needs to be solved. Can you tell us how it gets solved? Right? And there's a lot of this meta commentary coming through, framing it as a clearly a story that's being told that I think gives it very, very nice texture that's missing from Lord of the Rings.
Interesting. Yeah, that's fascinating. That is a good point. I didn't even really think of that aspect of The Hobbit, of it sort of playing with the voice of the narrator, but of course it does. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it even opens with that, right? Like, I suppose that hobbits need an introduction, right? And then let me go and describe to you what a hobbit is.
Okay. Let me just throw down one book here I don't think it is actually in Appendix N. But there's a novel called The Worm Ouroboros by E.R. Edison, and it predates a lot of this stuff, written in 1922. And so this is a point where you didn't have a fantasy section in bookstores. It's prior to The Hobbit. It's prior to Lord of the Rings. And again, it has a fascinating framing device that's actually kind of troubling, and I think about it a lot, is it starts in a very unique way. And it ends in a completely mind-blowingly unique way. And if you haven't read The Worm Ouroboros, it has so many interesting ideas for fantasy stories and warfare and castles. And I've never seen a story or a book that ends the way that this one does. And I highly recommend it. I'm so glad I read that kind of late in my life.
It's a very vague recommendation there, Dan. So that is that it, you're thinking it digs into that concept of what we're talking about with the separation of narrator and the actual characters in the game or in the story.
It's I feel like it kind of laid down a bit of a tradition or it set a bar that is almost impossible to reach again as far as completely mind-blowing frame shift from where you start into a world, into a story, and then back out at the end again.
Interesting.
And that one's a dense, interesting, full of ideas book.
I've got some unusual things to toss at you, Dan. Now this is, I got some later stuff that is clearly influenced by that is like bringing in the existence of role play in D&D into the actual framing. But that's, I feel like those are the two elements that I want to see, that I really want to see, are I want to see a team. Like, it's like, of all the old stuff in the original Appendix N, only, I think, Lieber gets this, right? Having at least a duo with Fafford and the Grey Mouser, yeah, rather than just a single protagonist. And then I want to see playing with the sort of duality of the real world versus the fantasy world. Maybe you get a little bit of that in Paul Anderson's... help me out here, Dan. That's the classic one. Paul Anderson with
Three Hearts and Three Lions. Right?
Three Hearts and Three Lions. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend this. Again, I'm glad you brought that up, Paul, because I've often said for my money, this has the densest source of D&D ideas. And it's basically the source for the D&D concepts of paladins and Scottish speaking dwarves and swan maze and holy sword and how trolls work. And on and on and on. And as you say, it starts with a real world person being drawn and alignment. The whole idea of D&D alignment basically comes out of this book, basically. And werewolves and how elves, the fact that elves are both fighters and wizards come out of this book. And on and on and on and on and on. And you're right, it has that same framing device of a real world person, a real world fighter in World War II. Being dropped into a fantasy world and having to fight an analogous battle against evil forces there. That is a critical book. If you haven't read it, you've got to read that if you're a D&D player.
All right, here's a book that's actually come up in the stream several times in the past for various reasons. It is The Sleeping Dragon by Joel Rosenberg, first book in the Guardians of the Flame series, very specifically about a group of college students playing a fantasy role-playing game. I don't think they use the words Dungeons and Dragons, but it's obviously Dungeons and Dragons. And they get transported into the actual fantasy world. They inhabit their characters, and their whole goal is to escape back to the real world. Grittier than one would expect, a little, right? Like, it toys a little bit with the idea that, like, actually, fantasy world's pretty horrible. You've got that duality of the real world versus the fantasy world. You've got it's a group to, you know, there's a group of protagonists, not just one. There is kind of a main character in it, but there's still a party of players, of characters. There's definitely some stuff in this book that's a little dated. I don't remember exactly when this book came out. There's some concepts that are maybe a little cringy in it, but it's strong. I think it's a good book.
Yeah, I read that in a number of books in the series at the same time as you, Paul. And, you know, it was a strong concept at the time. D&D was, undergoing its first explosion in popularity. So it was a strong concept. Has that same idea of real world players being dropped into the game world, and there's party that kind of wants that as a fantasy actually, and I think many of us the series the first book was the strongest one. The first one or two books was probably the strongest.
I want to say that it's maybe five books in total, but my instinct was always it should have ended as a trilogy. Like, I think the first three books are good, and that's where it should have stopped. And so I would say read the first three, and then you're done.
Yeah,
forget the fact
that extra books
are made after that.
I agree with that. And it's a lot like movies. I've heard, you know, the iron law of movies for series is only the last one loses money. And, you know, so Paul, I see, I'm looking online here. I see there are 10 novels in that series. 10.
What? Really?
Jeez.
Yeah.
I think I only own five. I think the fifth one is when I was like, yeah, I'm done.
if I hadn't looked it up online right now, I could have believed there was five. But yeah, there's a 10th published in 2003, I see. The title was Not Really the Prisoner of Zelda. Zenda, mm-hmm. Sorry. Not Really the Prisoner of Zenda. Mm.
Much more recently, I read Critical Failures by Robert Bevan, also a series of which there are a surprising number of books. Same basic concept, group of modern players playing a game called Caverns and Creatures. I would say clearly playing third edition D&D in the first book, at least, get transported into the fantasy world. In this case, it's played for laughs. It is a highly comedic book. Some of the humor is a little puerile, I will warn you. But but I enjoyed it. I cackled out loud while reading this book.
I have so many books here on my desk. I'm trying to whole library here. That's interesting. That's one I had not heard about, Paul. I'm glad you told me about that.
Yeah, you should. I'd recommend it. I definitely, there are moments in that book where I just, you know, and there's some very good in-jokes for folks who are familiar with D&D in there. Okay. But again, I would say my warning is like, you know, if you're not amused by dick and fart jokes, maybe not.
So here is, so on that same kind of theme of same basic era as the Guardians of Fame series, and another story that has a real world person falling into the fantasy world. Here's something that was really amazingly important to me at one point in my life is, I think when I was around 10, I think for Christmas, one of my aunts went to a bookstore and got, well, here's the beginning of a fantasy series. I think Dan will like it. And got me the first book in the Thomas Covenant series by Stephen R. Donaldson. And of course the first book here is Lord Foulsbane. I think that, you know, up through the 80s, there were two trilogies. There was a first trilogy and a second trilogy. Now, if you're talking, you know, gritty, frankly, this was too mature for me at the time. Okay, this actually screwed me up for a number of years, frankly, just as I was becoming a teenager, to be perfectly frank. And the main character is, you know, a troubled anti-hero, and the very first thing he does in the fantasy world is a horribly traumatic crime, frankly. And the rest of the series is colored by his blasphemous violation that he did. So really dark. In some ways, it's a mature retelling of Tolkien, of Lord of the Rings. It has a Lord of the Rings sort of echo in a lot of ways. And there are citizens who kind of sort of echo elves, and there are citizens that kind of sort of echo dwarves under different names. And the lead character does have a magic ring that almost never works for him. I guess I like it. There's lots and lots and lots of stuff you could pull out of here to be used in D&D games. I really do like the first two series a lot. And the funny thing about both those trilogies is I like best the middle book. For some reason, the middle book of the two trilogies, you know, they've set the premise and then he can kind of go off in a really unexpected, surprising direction, be very flexible. And then the third book, he's got to rein it back in and have the conclusion that was planned. And so the Ill-Earth War in the first series, book two there, and also the One Tree in which people are questing over the ocean and it's a seagoing adventure, really, really, really captured my imagination. And I like those series a lot, even though it frankly kind of emotionally traumatized me for a number of years. So I have mixed emotions about it. Probably read that about twice, two or three times, I think.
Fascinating. I've not read it myself, so I don't have much to contribute here, but I certainly know plenty of people who do sing its praises.
I might not recommend it be read. I mean, honestly, I don't think I can read it again. And the I mean, that was really
fascinating.
That was really my introduction to fantasy stories, right? And at the time, you buy novels. That's what's in the bookstore. And now I think that I have been convinced that short stories are a more punchy art form. And I think I would really rather prefer reading short stories. And those are, frankly, big, long, dense, wordy, not the fastest paced books. I'm not sure I'll ever read them again, frankly.
Interesting. I got a weird one here for you, Dan, that I'm sure is not on your list. And I'm gonna go out on a limb and guess that you've never heard of this. Ready?
Try me.
That is the 1986 comic book Crossed Swords.
You win. Yeah. You win, sir. I don't know what that is.
This is 9-year-old Paul in the comic book store willing to buy just about anything that looks remotely Dungeons & Dragons related in any way. Mm-hmm. As far as I can tell in my research, I don't know that there was ever an issue 2 of this thing. I think maybe
this is it.
I think maybe this is it. The art's not fantastic. It's not the best. Not the best artwork I've ever seen. The writing is okay. But what jumps out about this for me is just how D&D it is. I mean, clearly somebody was playing D&D and they were like, let's make a comic book out of it. And this is 1986, right? So it's very early stuff. You've got a fight with a purple worm. You've got a doppelganger in it, and at the end, you have got the actual dungeon went through, fully stocked, so you can run it for your players.
Oh my god!
Yep.
Oh, yes.
Yep. So you can run this thing yourself. You can run what the characters went through. and it's just chock full of D&D tropes. The central plot is an evil wizard rescues these two fighters who are about to die, and then teleports them off into some dungeon to go retrieve something for him or something. It's something very, you know, feels very forced. Did I run that dungeon? I don't think I've ever run it. I'm not sure if it's I don't know if it hold up, frankly, but let me tell you, reading this thing as a kid and even reading it now, I flip through the pages and I'm like, oh, this feels like playing D&D. I want to play D&D after reading it. And frankly, I'm annoyed that I haven't been able to find an issue 2, because it totally ends with a cliffhanger of this guy coming out and being like, that's not me, that's a doppelganger. And now they're going to fight.
That's great.
Yep.
Of course, in the 80s, there was a long-running series by Wendy Pinney, Elf Quest. Is that what it was? That feels too obvious. I wasn't going to come up with that. I've never read a single bit of it, but of course I'm told that it's like, the art is kind of confusing in that it's like a surprisingly mature story. And of course, you know, that's something that's both drawn and written by the same person, which is always an interesting take. So for comics of that time, there was quite a bit of that stuff, rolling around.
Yep. 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 Yep.
So I think we're mostly focused on stuff that's not in the actual Appendix N. And let me give a shout out.
Yeah, you want to go back to Appendix N, the original?
Well, maybe in a bit, but so another thing that you know, it's funny that maybe you might say it's not super D&D, but I've the T.H. White's The Once and Future King has been a huge touchstone for me, and for some reason I keep reading this every 10 years. So I read it first when I was 10, read it again when I was 20 and 30. I won't tell you how many more times I've read it. But every time I reread it, I discover extra stuff, like stuff that I didn't understand what he was saying the prior time that I read it. And like as I kind of go through my life, I think I understand more and more of it every time I reread it. So that's a funny book that seems to contain multitudes that I still haven't fully explored yet. So I a couple of us mentioned the D&D's and Demigods book earlier in the chat, and there's a lot of stuff that I think a lot of us discovered literature through the D&D's and Demigods book. And of course, they have a section on Arthurian legends. So for some of us, it's a bit of a struggle of how much Arthurian stuff do you put into your D&D game. But, there is some stuff there. And particularly how the witch interacts with the unicorn that always has captured my imagination, that I feel kind of needs to be part of my D&D world, frankly.
I mean, one of the things that I feel like we dance around a bit here is that sense of theme, right? Of like how epic versus how pastiche is the book, mm-hmm. Or is the story. And I think you and I, Dan, both agree that we don't want something super epic. But I would say that tastes on that possibly have shifted over the years, and more gamers, I'm not to say all of them, but more modern gamers are looking for some big sweeping epic or something more serious in tone than what we're used to. And I'm not sure that we can say that is or is not D&D, right? I'm not sure that it's that's I think the hardest thing to pin down, right? Is that D&D encompasses so much, right? Right? Mm-hmm. It is itself built on all these inspirational works. How do you then reverse that and say, now I'm going to make a movie about D&D? Well, it's like saying I'm going to make a movie about fiction, right? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah. And I agree with your critique at the start of the show here. And as I've said a couple times, like the weakness in trying to make a movie about D&D is, to me, D&D's mechanics. And it does, the D&D rule book normally doesn't have places or things or characters, which are what are your sellable IP is. And so for me, if they were making a movie about Greyhawk or the Forgotten Realms or Drizzt or Mordenkainen or something like that, that would seem like a more reasonable content to actually dig into. And mm-hmm. having it be, like you say, you might as well make a movie of like, fantasy adventure, the movie. Right, and it's kind of questionable that they really have a strong concept when they do that. I hope they're successful this time. That would be a pleasant refreshment.
I hope so too. But it's a tough job that they've set themselves up for. Right, yeah. Right. It's trying to bring all of those audiences together and say, like, here is a satisfying thing that you're all going to be happy has the label Dungeons and Dragons on it. That's tough. That is quite tough. I agree. Like, I don't, why isn't there a, Dragonlance movie? Spoiler alert, there was a cartoon with Kiefer Sutherland. We don't talk about that.
Really? Really?
I didn't know that there was an animated movie about Dragonlance.
I did not.
Kiefer Sutherland. I think Lucy Liu does a voice. There's a bunch of. It was a very 90s.
Really?
Very 90s voice cast.
That sounds very good. Yeah. How could that be bad? Yeah. How could that be bad?
I don't know. How do you make Jeremy Irons act so poorly?
I had memory hold that, sir. I'm not happy you brought that back. That hurt.
All right. Let's jump back. Is there other stuff from the original Appendix N that you wanted to bring up that we've missed?
Oh, so much. Okay, let me try to hit the hype. God, this just hurts me. Oh my goodness. Okay, DeCamp, right? I think you got to read DeCamp's The Fallible Fiend, because that's where you get the original D&D conception of the planes and summoning unreliable creatures, and also just a really a great take on being a foreigner. It's mostly from the perspective of the summoned alien and what it's like to be a, have bigotry around you and have people making fun of you because you don't understand the customs, and a really great creation of a completely novel fantasy world where every single kingdom is unique and completely bonkers in its own way, and the citizens of that country are completely 100% comfortable that that their culture is the only way, only thing that's possibly reasonable. And The Fallible Fiend is a lovely, lovely book for lots of reasons like that. If you're gonna run the Giant series, I feel that you need to read the first story in DeCamp and Pratt's Harold Shea series, The Roaring Trumpet. So the whole, Gygax's whole Giant series is the basic concept is lifted directly out of The Roaring Trumpet down to the types of the giants and what the structures look like and what's on what level of the fire giants hall and stuff like that. And I feel like if you're going to DM, you're going to run that. You got to read that first Harold Shea story. Fast and the Grey Mouser, Conan, yeah.
Let me
the Elric stories, let me all that pulp stuff. More, but Paul.
let me jump in. Let me jump in here. First, very, very, very quick aside. I've been corrected in the chat that the Dragonlance animated movie came out in 2008, not the 90s. And there's probably a lot that I got wrong about it. But I don't think I got wrong about it was that it was terrible. Okay. DeCamp.
Yeah, it seems the consensus is it was bad.
Yeah. For me, I want to talk about the Goblin Tower. Okay. Goblin Tower strikes me as very D&D. You've got this super interesting character whose main goal is to simply not be king anymore. So he's trying to evade that. He's trained himself up in the he's kind of classic thief type, right? His main skill is like he knows how to like pick locks and whatnot. And other kind of like thiefy type stuff. But what really knocks me out about the Goblin Tower is how many left turns this story takes. That routinely it seems like he's on the path to go accomplish some goal and just really random crap. He just stumbles into there's this whole bit about him going through a jungle and accidentally coming across an abandoned civilization and picking up a statuette that turns out to be inhabited by a god that no one worships anymore. Time after time, this story takes bizarre left turns. And I'm like, where are we going with this thing? And for me, that is very reminiscent for me of a D&D campaign. Like rarely does a D&D campaign for me follow a nice, classic story arc. Right. Of beginning, middle, end, right? D&D is all middle.
Yes.
Yeah. So
and it's really funny like you bring up that particular aspect of the forgotten god idol, because that appears in Michael Curtis's Stonehell. And when we played that, I was the victim. I was the victim of getting half possessed by the forgotten frog god idol that nobody worshipped anymore, trying to get my character to resuscitate the faith. So I have been on the receiving end of that. Thank you, DeCamp.
In this case, the forgotten god is kind of benign and wants to help. He's like, great, I'm up from zero to one worshipers, woohoo. Yeah. I would love to help you, but also I'm basically powerless. Like, I can't really do very much for you. And it's just fascinating. It's just a weird, and it's like one of those things, I think, like in a D&D campaign where you pick up some random, like what seems like a very powerful magic item, and you're like, I guess I have this now. I'll stick it in my pocket. It'll come up later.
That pretty much matches my experience.
Yeah.
So that's great. That's great.
Yeah. So for me, that's the classic DeCamp story that I want. You were going on. You're putting past DeCamp.
Goblin Tower is not officially listed on Appendix N. It says it's for DeCamp. It says less darkness fall, Fallible Fiend et al. So I will permit it.
Oh, because I will permit it on this show
under the et al. It sounds like a great story.
Okay, I want to talk about one of your favorites now, which I'm shocked you haven't brought up yet. But here I'm bringing up your appendix N again, and of course, what about Lovecraft?
Well, I was leaving that for last year. Well, I always say I feel he's the root. I feel that he's the root. And so many of these authors, you know, that came later were directly in touch with him, right? So he was very, you know, again, say what you want about his shortcomings. From what we know, he was very generous with his time writing to other authors and supporting and encouraging them. And many of these other authors, when they were young, they were corresponding with Howard Phillips Lovecraft, taking ideas from him. And so ideas of the old ones and the Cthulhu mythos show up in, you know, Howard and Conan and Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser and Elric, maybe with the serial numbers filed off, as we all do. And I feel like, so for me, the Cthulhu mythos, the, you know, Dunwich horror and also the Dream Quest of Unknown Caddith, where he has a whole fantasy world that a real world person gets dropped into, are really, really important for me. And I feel it's extremely important. And again, at the bottom of Gygax's Appendix N, he specifically lists like five, right? I think there's five that he says, and these are the most important of all. And he says, DeCamp and Pratt, Robert Howard, Fritz Lieber, Jank Vat, Jack Vance, HPL, which is Lovecraft, and also Merritt. So I feel that you know, for me, I feel like I had to read Lovecraft, and I'm not normally a horror guy. I didn't pursue horror. I stayed away from it. I'm still terrified of Errol Otis's art for the Cthulhu mythos in the Deities and Demigods book. But, you know, and the other thing is it's, I guess, how should I put this? It's a non-biblical mythology, right? So it's a, for the pulp literature that was being written in the 20s, 30s, 40s, it incorporates these scientific advances as we were understanding, you know, the larger universe and relativity and Einstein's theories and things like that. And a lot of these pulp stories by those guys have this skepticism, right? Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser are highly skeptical. Someone does a magic trick and they go, well, that was probably just mirrors, or they had it on a string or something like that. They're fundamentally skeptical that there's even magical stuff in the world. And Lovecraft kind of has that. Lovecraft has fairly reasonable kind of science fiction explanations for these things that appear to be supernatural. And to me, I feel like that's very pulpy and it's very D&D that we can take something that was supernatural and give mechanics and statistics and an explanation to it. And it's not entirely just, well, there's magic and we'll never explain it, because we actually have rules to do so. So I feel that that understanding of the universe is very much at the root of D&D.
I want to go back and pick on a little bit. You're talking about just like horror and what place does horror have in D&D. And one of the things I find really fascinating is we were talking a lot about the trope of having a real world, modern day real world character gets thrust into a fantasy world. And I'm getting lost trying to connect the dots in my head. Here we go. So the fascinating thing is if you look at your classic fantasy story, you have your protagonists in those stories, you know, just accept that the world is this way. There are dragons and elves and wizards and et cetera. And they go about their business and they do, you know, usually pretty heroic stuff, right? Whereas all you have to do is take a modern day character and say, this is a normal person, you know, a college student in the case of Rosenberg, or or is it a World War II air
soldier
pilot? Yep. Soldier, yeah. Some, you know, in the case of Paul Anderson, yeah. Shove them into that world, and they just discover, no, this is horrible. This is terrifying, and mm-hmm. thank goodness this stuff does not exist in the real world, because it's bad.
Yeah,
just fascinating. Yeah, right? I think just right. fascinating. Yeah. You just need that perspective of no. What would it be like if there really were dragons? Oh, awful is the answer. Quite awful.
I agree with that. I agree with that. Fairly recently I saw a blogger describing classic D&D as unrelentingly gritty survival horror, was the essence of original first edition D&D. And I was like, that's a great description. That really is very much on the nose. Is it? It is kind of, again, original D&D, you would be massacring a fairly significant proportion of your players in every game session. And many people didn't bother to name their characters until they got to third level. It was so unusual.
The motivation of these characters is questionable, right? Like the notion that you're in this world where these horrible things exist, and we're going to assemble a team of fairly inexperienced people to go into the most dangerous parts of this, to intentionally encounter the most horrible occupants of this world in order to get rich. It's kind of shocking.
Well, I leaned into that in my original D&D games that I think you can tell a story in which apparently the rest of their lives are arguably even worse. So apparently they must be coming from a place of poverty and possible starvation and disease and horrible leadership. That maybe their normal life is even worse. And or at least that the prospect of what's in the dungeon, they can maybe deceive themselves that this is a better option. And I actually kind of lean into that when I bring new people into a play of original D&D. Okay. So
that's surprisingly dark for a role playing game.
Let me bring. Well, you know what? It's unrelentingly gritty survival horror. So here's Ash, kind of anticipating what I said there. Of I mean, it's basically capitalism with potentially more reward. Is Ash's take? Thank you for that, Ash.
Oh dear.
That is sort of that actually is the take from players when I do my normal start of an OD&D campaign. They go, Oh, I see what's happening. But I mean, there are people in the real world that make bad choices. There are people that make, you know, like I'm sure we can all think of some examples of people making bad choices recently.
Fascinating. Interesting because like a game like just as a counterpoint, a game like Fiasco very intentionally leans into this notion, right? Of like the point of Fiasco is to play terrible people with poor impulse control, right? I think is their tagline. You're playing terrible people with poor impulse control, and then we all have a laugh at them. But I don't think I've ever seen D&D pitched as you're going to play a group. A group of adventurers who have made a really bad decision. They've fallen for this ludicrous get-rich-quick scheme. They bought their 10-foot rope, and they're going down the well.
I mean, I feel that that's Lieber. I mean, I feel that's Fafford and the Grey Mouser. They're making terrible decisions all the time. They're making terrible, horrible decisions, and they're repeatedly being unnecessarily skeptical and denying that what they actually saw happened. That's a common thing, is that something happens right in front of them, and then they convince themselves that they didn't see it. Right? Like, oh, this is fine. That didn't happen. That's ridiculous. There must have been some kind of miasma or some kind of sparkle in the light or something. We should continue to go into this tower that's trying to kill us. It's physically trying to crush us from moment to moment. That seems like a good idea, right? And they do that over and over again, and then they get enormous amount of wealth, and they just piss it away, and they lose it all 2 days later. And then look how many pages have been written, and they keep doing that over and over again. That's among the best examples of a D&D game.
Here we are with 5 minutes left. Is that your final rec? Like, if you were going to say, read one thing, and I've never heard of D&D, and I've never read any of this stuff before, and I'm going to go play a D&D game, what's the one thing I should read first? Are you going Fafford and the Grey Mouser?
It's a strong prospect. I'll probably regret this 5 minutes from now. but it's a strong prospect. I think that might be the most D&D type stories and attitude that I know of.
Yeah,
pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's
right in there.
I, And I'm chuckling here at Vance, who's added end shopping montages, right? Yes, let's. Yes.
Well, I think that was the. I think that was a follow up to the D&D as expedition to the Amazon warehouse, which was being pitched by as a possible module.
Yeah.
You know the original D&D doesn't have an appendix N, doesn't have a listing or a bibliography. But it is pitched as, here's a game that if you are interested in playing Fafnir the Grey Mouser or Elric or Conan, that's usually tends to be the trinity that is initially being pitched in the original D&D books is Fafnir the Grey Mouser, Conan, and Elric. And that is a really super strong starting point to really understanding where the fantasy war game was being pitched.
Interesting. It'd be a good D&D party. Fafnir, Grey Mouser, Conan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Throw in Gandalf or somebody. Something like that. Now, before we go out, I mean, so many things we didn't get to that's important to us that isn't an Appendix N. All kinds of mythology. Okay, I feel it's all kinds of mythology. I have read and reread. I have multiple translations of the Iliad. Gilgamesh is mind-blowing the first time I read it. The Tarn, the Irish epic that tells the story of Cuchulainn, who goes to a trainer and learns a whole bunch of feats. Learns all kinds of feats. The feat of cutting an apple and fighting from the edge of a shield and going berserk in a fjord. And the whole idea of feats basically comes out of this. Dante's Divine Comedy gives us all kinds of demons and devils in D&D and basically how they set up hell. So that kind of traditional literature is incredibly important too. So that could be like a whole other episode. Science fiction, right? We keep coming up with like science fiction books that are important. Alfred Bester's Stars My Destination basically gave us how teleport works in D&D. I feel that, again, that's a hard book. That's a gritty book. It's an unpleasant main character, but there's a lot of ideas even from those science fiction books that became key in D&D. So all kinds of other stuff.
Interesting.
Let me, one more comment here from Eric Worldbender. But no clerics though. I agree. Thank you, Eric. A lot, you know?
Yeah.
Spell casting, clergy in plate mail don't appear in almost any book, any of those pulp books that I know of. That comes from a different source. So
I mean, I think we see them in Howard, but they're usually trying to kill Conan. Right? Is what they're after.
And then they're evil and they don't wear plate armor and they're not healing.
Yeah. Mm. Yep. It's true.
There are evil priests. I agree with that. Sure.
Yeah. Like they're evil, they're divinely, inspired by a god and casting magic for sure. And are they not wearing plate mail? I don't know. I feel like there's a story that's on the tip of my, I'm just not reaching it. Anyway. We are just about out of time, Dan. Any final thoughts on our Appendix N?
Apologies in advance for all the things we forgot. We bit off a huge, important topic to us. I didn't mention Clark Ashton Smith. Probably should have mentioned him. Moldvay includes him. He's important to Module X2. I'm currently fighting Etienne d'Amberville in my games from the Elder Times on Tuesday nights, and hopefully I'll be able to defeat him. Thank you, Clark Ashton Smith, for that tradition. and probably a whole bunch of other stuff that... that I'll try to bring up probably next week when I realize what I forgot.
Yeah, I mean that's I think that's the key takeaway is that our Appendix N is vast, that D&D is vast. Yeah. D&D is a very difficult thing I think to pigeonhole into saying like this is D&D and this is not, which makes it. It's easy to go in the direction of the listing all the things that inspired D&D, but then to try and take D&D as inspiration and make something out of that, I think that's really, really hard.
So. I agree with that. I tend to want to, take some other source as the starting point. And when D&D starts to, if, when D&D starts when D&D starts to become only about D&D, I find that to be less interesting. And you know, the game is initially verbal, and so using words and being literary makes sense for tradition. But of course, if you're someone that takes a lot of inspiration from comic books or TV or movies, that's all great. That's all great. And maybe we could have other people come on and tell us about what comics or movies or TV shows I'm not aware of that that I should use for more inspiration in my D&D games.
All right, well, that's our time. Folks, if you have you want to list all those comics, movies, or other books that we've missed, what's in your appendix, and leave them in the comments of the video here. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that will inspire a new conversation or an extension of this one down the road for us. So let us know what you think.
Yes, please. And remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, The Wandering DMs, on places like YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook and GitHub and also TikTok. And we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites. So look for us there and you'll get updates.
Excellent. If you prefer to listen to us in audio-only podcast format, you can do that on our website at wanderingdms.com or through various podcast carriers such as iTunes, Google Podcast, Stitcher, any of those places. If you are listening to this right now through a third-party podcast carrier, please take a moment to rate and review us on their site. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, it really does. A couple of thanks here. Big thanks to Bill Rubin for giving us the idea for today's episode. And Bill, I know you just got in the chat a little while ago. You go look at the recording because it's a pretty good discussion. And if you are interested in seeing us interview someone who was an Appendix N author, please go look at our episode from last week where we did interview Ramsey Campbell, who is one of the authors of the Swords and Wizardry series, which I think gave the idea to Bill Rubin for us to have this conversation today. So look for that. For Ramsey last week. And of course, enormous thanks to our patrons who support us, the Wandering DMs. If you would like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll see a couple different tiers, discounts on merch, access to a private Discord server, bunch of other stuff, including after party chat. And as usual, we'll be there on our Discord server to continue the video chat with our patrons live in about 10 minutes or so. Are you going to be there for that, Paul?
Yep, I sure will.
Cool. Also look for upcoming shows. I will be back Tuesday night as I attempt to put a pin in fighting Etienne d'Amberville, inspired by the Averon stories in the D&D Known World of Mystera, who is a 36th level mage, and I probably shouldn't have picked him for my first opponent, but I did. So we'll see if I can survive that Tuesday night. TDR is off this Thursday because some of us are traveling to Massachusetts for our first HouseCon together, where I'm going to be with Paul actually gaming next weekend. And then next Saturday we'll be on. I think we're going to do a recap for the first time in 3 years. We used to do this a lot, Paul. We used to go to a convention, then Sunday afternoon do a recap, and we get to do that again for the first time this Sunday. Next Sunday.
Yeah, that's super exciting. If you go back into our older shows, you'll see actually quite a few from the convention floor of various cons, whether it was PAX or PAX Unplugged or mm-hmm. TotalCon. HelgaCon, which is our little local one that we do every April, or used to do every April. Haven't done it in 2 years, so excited to finally get back to it. Maybe we'll pull a special guest or two from the convention in to show their face on camera. Maybe
that's no promise. I like that. That's a great idea. So we'll report next week on what it's like to be back with a bunch of people actually gaming. And, you know, some of us have to get over some nerves, frankly. And I'm not surprised about that. So we'll give you a report on how that went next Sunday. So we hope you'll join us for that. We are, of course, live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for yet another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.